Well, now it's Conversations with Linda, so we're going to take your phone calls. And if you're a whistleblower, make sure you check in with us as well. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're going to take Conversations with Linda and lots to talk with Linda about. Hey, by the way, Linda, how many years you've been doing this for us now?
Well, do you mean going back to Art when Art and I were...
Even then, yeah. I know you've been doing it for me since 2003. How many years even before that?
Well, it goes back to Bob Bigelow started Area 2000 with George Knapp and me back in, I think it was like around 1999, 2000 or something. And then I believe it was in 2001... Bob Bigelow decided that he didn't want to keep doing the radio, and Art called me up and said, I've got an idea for a radio program called Dreamland. Would you work with me on it? And so it's got to be that far back, 2001, and that's when I carried around an analog audio tape, you know, the larger cassette.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
The tape recorder was about 12 inches by 10 inches. By 2 or 3 inches. And wherever I was, literally in the world, whether I was in England or whether I was in some other country or whatever city I was in the United States, Art never knew. He said, just call me an hour before we're going to go live and tell me what phone number to call you. And that I would be in phone booths and I'd have that audio tape recorder. And it would be, I didn't have the ability to edit, you know, on the road or with that audio cassette. So I would have to manually find whatever was the best minute or so from the audio, no matter where I was. And then I would take the receiver, the payphone receiver, and put the mouthpiece down on the microphone or the speaker in the recorder. And we did that for about a year or two. It was absolutely one of the most fun times of my life because I was completely free to cover anything and everything, and it was so raw. And I've been told that people absolutely loved those reports because they were so raw. Today, we're always fighting, apparently, for audio quality, and back then, for a couple of years, it didn't matter. And then Art said one day, you know, I think we should upgrade what you are doing with the mouthpiece to
things,
the tape recorder.
Technology just got better and better. Anyways, you have done a great job for us.
Well, thank you very much. And I was just going to conclude with this for all of you to contemplate. Art would call me and say, hey, can you work with me tomorrow night for 5 hours? Remember, he did 5 hours.
Oh, yeah. He would do that once in a while.
He would call me the day before and say, can you do 5 hours with me tomorrow on global warming? And I would take every newspaper article, magazine, every single anything that I had, and I would make these bullseye rings on the floor, 360, and I would sit with the phone and hoping that I had enough material to sustain 5 live hours.
That is amazing. Well, look, you've done a great job for us, and this may sound a little tacky, but we've had some cutbacks, and tonight's going to be your last night on the program.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I didn't know how to tell you, and I didn't want to do it in a phone call, so I thought I would tell you on April 1st.
Oh, I hope this is a joke.
April 1st, I thought I'd tell you.
Well, I'm going to file a...
You're finally speechless.
April joke, yes.
Of course it's an April Fool's.
So, I've been doing this for a very, very long time. I really love it.
You were actually in shock, weren't you?
Well, I wasn't sure. It sounded like a joke to me, but I wasn't sure.
Oh, let's go to the phone. You ready?
Yes.
We'll go to West Virginia. Jerry, first-time caller. You're with Linda Moulton now on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Jerry.
How you guys doing?
Good, Jerry. Thank you.
Hey, got to say that you guys are doing a great job. Appreciate it. Just a couple of things. I just had on my mind, I try to get a hold of you a lot. all these things are going on that we talk about all the time. Like, I'm getting a little bit older. I'm getting close to 40. I'm just wondering how much of it is actually just, you know, getting older, worrying more, having kids and things like that, or the facts of everything that's going on. And plus, also, I was wondering, when things like this happen that cause disasters, what would happen to somebody that was incarcerated, you know? And also,
like, give me an example, like an earthquake and it hits a prison or something like that.
Well, say, yeah, anything like that, that there's a bunch of stuff going on like that. And it's just, or like, end of times, you know, theory, say that something like that happens and you have a relative in prison, what would you expect to happen? And another thing too, I'm contemplating moving back to Florida. You know, I lived there for 25 years. I'm a surfer, and, I'm almost afraid to get in the water. I mean, who's to say that the radiation isn't, like, catching the currents? You know, I don't know. You know, what do you think about moving back to Florida in the next year? Should I stay here in West Virginia or go there?
Well, you know, Jerry, the way I come at this, and I'll have Linda chat with you too, I'm not the kind of person to say, look, you've got to run away from what could be or what might be. I mean, you do what you think you want to do, and hope for the best. I mean, you can't let events dictate your lifestyle, your future, or anything like that. As far as inmates are concerned, that could be a huge problem if an earthquake hits where all these people are incarcerated, where, by the way, we have a huge coast listenership there. Linda, what do you think of this?
Well, I'm thinking of the cover of Newsweek this week is Apocalyptic Times. And it's on everyone's lips these days, and that Japan, the size and the scope of the horror in Japan that just keeps on unfolding like dominoes falling, I think sets the tone for this gentleman's question. And I know that I get emails from a lot of people saying, I feel like I should move. Where do you think I should move? And my philosophy is that on a planet that is round, and that is moving into a time in which I personally think that the data on global warming is solid, it is there, the planet is warming up, the extremes of winter and snow and ice was always part of the computer projections, and that weather and climate would continue to become more and more intense, and therefore, anyone contemplating living on the coast has to keep in mind that hurricanes and floods will be probably part of their future. And if you're on the West Coast, a big earthquake, either at Juan de Fuca up at the Spokane-Tacoma end or down through California to San Diego. And all of this seems to me to be part of a gestalt that everyone is feeling, that the Earth itself is moving through a changeable time, and it is dragging all of us with it.
Well, and the New Madrid Fault as well, Linda. That could be a problem, too.
That's true. Absolutely. I got a very interesting... sometimes you get phone calls or emails, and there's no way to prove, but I got a very interesting communication just about 3 weeks ago from somebody who said that they had inside knowledge that there was a federal program of great concern about how to evacuate people from the Midwest if the New Madrid Fault should let go.
Good point. Okay, next up we go to Nick in Corning, California. Hey, Nick, welcome to the program. You're up with us.
Hello, George. You are a host that never disappoints. And Linda, you've got to have the most sexiest IQ I've ever heard. And George, if you ever say that she's going to never come back, my aorta is going to explode.
Well, now Linda knows that I have a touch of class here. I would never do that to her on the air anyway.
And I have seen him be quite funny back in the press club earlier in a year ago. And so that's why I'm always feeling like that there's always this glint behind most of what you're saying.
Right. You guys. All right. Well, I'm calling because Linda was speaking to a previous caller, and it involved you had mentioned heat accompanying a UFO sighting, and also the hair standing on your arms. Well, back in 1988, I guess I was around 27 or so, I was with two friends, a guy and a girl, and a dog, which was part of our family. His name was Bo. He was a black Labrador, and we knew all of his behavior, so anything out of the ordinary would be spotted immediately as, you know, unordinary. We were out there, and we were under a tree, and we had only had about three beers at that point. And so we were lucid, and all of a sudden I was looking across the field that we're sitting in. I had noticed this little red dot that just kept slowly going over the horizon. It was going in a straight line, and then it would wink out. And then I noticed it would wink back in where it had started from. And then it traveled in the same direction, and then it winked out. When it winked on again, another one winked in. So there were now two of these red, I guess the word would be phosphorescent, you know, that kind of fuzzy red-pink sort of glow. And the other one stayed stationary, while this one, the first one, I'm assuming it was the first one, it started coming over our direction and over the tree in a very slow way, and I heard no noise. And I followed the UFO situation for years, so I just kept it to myself. And I was watching this thing, and it gets right over the tree, and then it just hovers there. And I swear, it seemed like it was alive the way it was shining. It was just so strange. And then finally, it wasn't going anywhere. So he said, "Hey, Lynn, Mike, come here. You need to take a look at this." And we all stood there, and they know about my interest in UFOs. And I said, "What do you guys see? What do you think it is?" And the first thing that Mike, my friend, says is, "Oh man, that's just a helicopter with its emergency light on." Well, I knew that wasn't true. I turned to my friend Lynn and I said, "Do you hear any engine?" And she said, "No, as a matter of fact, I don't." And so Mike just turns away in dismissal. And right when it was hovering up there, we suddenly felt this big blast of warm heat that has no source anywhere in a factory area or anywhere in that area. It was a summer night, but the wind wasn't, it was a coolish wind. The next thing that began to happen was Bo, the dog, big black Labrador, was going crazy trying to dig a hole as if he was trying to dig himself into the ground. And Lynn, it was her dog, she said, "Oh, what are you doing? What is this?" You know, she's really exasperated over this behavior of the dog, and so was I. I'd never seen anything like it. Mike did say that he was getting the hairs standing up on his arms at some point around there, and that's kind of fuzzy to me. So I heard you mention those, and so I had that experience. I don't know what it was. Afterwards, that thing blinked out. It appeared again off to the horizon, and I had told Lynn, "Watch, it's going to do that," and it did that, and she was just like, "Whoa." And the strangest thing, and that was it. We finally left to go off downtown, but later, a couple of years later, I asked her about that, and I asked him about that. "You remember the time that we were sitting there?" They had absolutely no memory whatsoever.
Yeah, loss of memory by various individuals in groups, a complete and total silence by an object that is close enough to give off even a hum, but there's total silence, mm-hmm. electrostatic fields, and the heat from microwave. Those are four of the biggest common denominators of interactions with this phenomena. And when it comes to crop circles and animal mutilations, which I've investigated for three decades, that electrostatic energy, I have encountered it myself. It feels like you're hitting a jello wall to me. And then there is that hair rising, which is part of an electrostatic field. But the microwave in the Levittown, Pennsylvania case, Dr. Levengood, he theorized that those very thin, one-tenth of a millimeter straight, absolutely ruler straight lines on all of those leaves had somehow been done with some form of perhaps microwave energy extracting. That's the question. And I think what you have opened the door for in your own experience is that the craft seemed to be close over a nearby tree. And throughout not just this century and the last century, but in other centuries. There have been these reports in which the silent, large, glowing lights are often seen above or near a tree. Is there a technology that is extracting without even having to land, is able to extend photon energy, microwave energy, fields that we don't understand, and extract information, extract molecules, extract whatever they're extracting. And that might explain why those sparkles of light were over the privet and over the maple. And then she watched in astonishment as all of this glittering light, almost as if you would back up a film, went right back in a V up to that craft and disappeared. She did not see how all of that sparkly light entered that big disk. So clearly, when you come in to these common denominators of silence close up, heat, electrostatic energy, and people in a group who experience something and then later on, many of them never remember anything. That is one of the most common parts of the human drama when it comes to this phenomena. People, for whatever reason, it's as if their minds are completely erased, but one person will remember as if they are immune to whatever the erasure was.
Linda, are you still getting reports of the large triangular-shaped objects?
Yes, and it's very interesting that I was sent one of the videotapes from the Lafayette, Colorado, the recent red lights in the form of a triangle there. And as I was studying this videotape, and they're trying to get the videotaper in this one particular, there were several, to talk with me directly on the record. What I was impressed by is that I am listening to the live raw video, and the guy is trying very hard. It's very clear. He's hand-holding. It's not on a tripod, but he's trying to hold the camera very still. And at one point, he drops the camera down while he says, look, this is where we are. See the lights of the surrounding area. And then he tilts back up. And those three red lights, they are as tomato deep red as you could imagine. And they are in a triangle, perfect, over the 2 or 3 minutes of the videotape that I have. There is no motion. This is an absolutely stock still triangle. And at one point, the videotaper says, I can't hear anything. These lights seem close enough. Can any of you hear anything? And everybody says no. So whatever that was over Lafayette, Colorado, and if anybody listening has taken any of their own still photos or videotapes of this large triangle of red lights, I would sure like to hear at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. And that triangle of red lights, it has come up over periodically, but usually you hear about white lights at the three corners and red light in the middle. This is three red vertices of a triangle that is stock still in the dark sky.
I just hope one day we will truly get some answers that we really seek, Linda.
Yes, and why is it that the non-humans, the intelligence, the clearly advanced intelligence with advanced technology, does not interact straightforwardly with humans?
Well, that's a good point. Linda, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment as we've now made it into April 1st, another fast year. It's clicking along. And by the way, when you get into work or wherever you go on April 1st, just be aware of pranksters. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Oh, you've got an invitation through Jesse Dillon, Bob Dylan's son, to get Bob on the program when I get back to Los Angeles. So we'll see how that transpires. We'll come back. We'll take final phone calls with Linda Moltenhau in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Linda, as we go into spring now, any reports on the bumblebees? What's going on there?
Well, it is a story that I want to do to follow up a request for the EPA to get back involved in another lawsuit against, it's the Nature Conservancy and one of those groups to do a lawsuit against the Environmental Protection Agency based on their doing those registrations of bears, clothianidin, which is a nicotine-based pesticide that their own inside internal document says kills honeybees. It's in that document that was leaked. And so the next step for doing something in the news is that there are more than one lawsuit now that is being filed, and I'm waiting to have it more gelled, and then I'll do a coast on what is happening in lawsuits. It's not protecting and saving the bees, because unfortunately, when all of this goes into lawsuits, it still means that those EPA registrations of clothianidin are still out there. Nothing has changed. So that part is sad. During the break, I selected from email three really important and relevant ones to what I've reported tonight. And one comes from a woman who says, your interview tonight with a woman who observed the aerial disc, the drop-down squares of light stunned me. I have a friend who is now in her 70s and who experienced something very similar in the 1960s. In her case, the craft also hovered very low over her house. And she describes what was dropped down as being like sparkly tinsel or strips of foil. My friend and her family tried to gather these from the ground, but when they picked them up, the strips shriveled in their hands and disintegrated. The craft was observed by neighbors who remarked upon it, so there were eyewitnesses in addition to my friend and her family. All of this took place in Klamath Falls, Oregon. That is the kind of information that I hope if other people are listening and that they've had any kind of an experience similar to this falling, sparkling light around trees or anything else, I sure would like to hear at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. And I will try to follow up with this woman about this Oregon case. And now here is from a man living in the Gulf. I listened to your report about Gulf Coast illness and coast to coast. I have been sick, very sick, since February 28, 2011. I first had broken out into hives, a very bad rash on most of my body. Then I developed a horrible cough, which lasted for a month. Now I have a very severe sore throat, and my ears are even very painful. I have never been this sick in my life, and I am 50 years old. Something is very wrong. I had seafood from Louisiana. I think that was a big mistake. I'm very worried that this will ever go away now. And until this period, I had always been in great health. Again, I'm interested in other people who they may feel that in their town where they live, that they can't tell anybody that they're sick because politically it's unacceptable. But there is a political climate now that no one is supposed to talk about bad things in the Gulf. Well, we have to, as a nation, come together with facts and the truth if we're ever going to get better. And then third, just a couple of weeks ago, I interviewed Arne Gunderson, a nuclear engineer, and he was right on, nailed a lot of things about the evolving Fukushima situation, including that in the United States on the West Coast, we would be finding radioactive iodine in cow's milk by the end of March. And what was on CNN and other news stories today, that they have found radioactive iodine in cow's milk in California and in Washington State. Well, he sent an email just in the last half hour, important Fukushima Unit 4 camera footage surfaced today. Just released our analysis, and the new images reveal the nuclear fuel rack in Unit 4 is exposed to air.
Yep.
That is really bad news, because that's when nuclear fuel will catch fire. And if any of those units catches fire, if radioactivity is bad now, it's going to be beyond our understanding, really.
Yeah, I think, Linda, this is going to be something that affects people for years to come. People might not think about it when the time comes, but it's going to be there.
Years, decades.
Yeah. Let's go to Columbia, South Carolina. Jim's with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Linda, I wanted to talk with you about the Monroe County Crop Circle that was in eastern Tennessee. near Madisonville.
Yes.
I was lucky enough to know someone who got in on the original investigation and was able to tag along. The apex of the triangle that was in the center of the formation, the way the crop was woven together, and it was just amazing to finally see one firsthand. Were you able to go and visit that crop circle before it got too many visitors to it?
I never was there physically, but I was in conversation with people who were going there. Jeff Wilson with the Independent Crop Circle Research Group in Ohio, I think one of his people went there. And the photos, I was just looking at Madisonville, Tennessee in my Earth files, just to refresh. And if you'll just give me 1 second, I'll be looking at.
While you're looking that up, Jeff was there the day that I was there, and I got to help him in his investigation. But I got second and third hand feedback, so I never got any first hand feedback as to what his findings were.
Right.
There was some very interesting coincidences, the entire situation.
Well, I'm looking now at it. This is what I remembered in my own mind. And this was compared to some Mayan symbols. It has a very delicate triangle in the middle of a large ring. And then coming out of the ring are four circles, each on lines, forming cross hatches of circles, you might say, across the triangle in the ring. And then there are four very large circles that form a diamond pattern to the rest of it. And the man who first called me about this was Mark Boring. He was the co-owner and editor of the Monroe County Buzz. And he's the fellow who went out, helped Jeff. And I don't know if you met or worked with him, but everything that Jeff and I learned about that community, the people, the farm where this was, and this was 170 feet in diameter, so this was not small, and it was laid down in counterclockwise circles with that pointer triangle right in the center of the standing wheat, and discovered on May 15th, 2007, and that pointer triangle was pointing right at one of the Indian areas. It's Cherokee in that area. And this is one of Jeff Wilson's passions, is that he thinks that the crop formations in the United States, like crop formations in England, are focused around or are relating to ancient sites. And in the United States, some of the most interesting have related even to the Hopewell culture that goes back so mysteriously as far as perhaps 2,000-3,000 years ago. And that is one of the issues that came up on that Madisonville, Tennessee pattern.
All right.
Well, that's the first I'd heard of the Cherokee connection.
Yeah. If you have any other Indians around there, I know that the Cherokee Indian flag, I use it in my Earth Files report. I specifically went and studied various Tennessee, North Carolina, that area, who was there, and what flags and patterns did they have. And when you look at the Cherokee Indian flag, it has 9 stars, and that there is one which is dark or invisible that represents sort of a spiritual relationship with the unseen and the invisible. And the fact that there was this 9-fold geometry in the Madisonville pattern, and that the Cherokee Indian flag is based on 9 stars, one of which is sort of invisible or related to the unseen, I find absolutely fascinating. And if you have the time, if you go back through Earth Files, since my whole site is 2,000 reports now, chronological from the beginning of 1999 to the current day in chronological order in the archive. This June 6, 2007 report I did has aerials, ground shots, all this work that I did on the Cherokee Mayan, and other relationships that tie into this issue, not only of the number nine, but when you go back and look at the glyph on the Mayan Pakal tomb lid, that is, it is often seen as part of the Mayan where the figure is laying on their back, and some people say it is in a space rocket.
Yeah.
Well, right next.
That's Lord Pakal, I think.
That's right. And right next to where he's got his head resting, and he's looking up, right on the wall next to the Mayan figure's knees, is a glyph that is so similar to the Madisonville, Tennessee, that it is eerie.
Next up, Al is in British Columbia, Canada, on the international line. Go ahead, Al.
Hi, great show as usual. A question for Linda. The last time Travis Walton was on, you speculated that he may have been killed in that incident and then brought back to life, and you made other mention that other researchers had thought that maybe the aliens have got resurrection technology. So my question is, could it possibly be that in these cattle mutilations, the aliens are taking the cattle apart and putting them back together, and the mutilations that are found are incomplete or unsuccessful attempts?
I don't think so. That is a mystery that I've spent a good deal of my life with in the fields, close up, getting tissue directly from the animal so that I was getting the mutilator's cuts and putting it in formalin and putting my own cuts for comparison. And when you've done that as many times as I have in a field, and you've talked with law enforcement that are dealing with the phenomena and say, we're dealing with creatures from outer space, when the red lights show up with the beams and they look fiery, we're going to have animal mutilations. And I have, over the years, talked with some people, of course, only off the record would they talk, who have worked in intel agencies or military operations in and around animal mutilations. And what they have said to me would boil down to this. We know that we're dealing with at least one type of non-human intelligence that is using Earth for a genetic harvest. What makes us nervous is what is all of the genetic harvest being applied to.
Good point. Okay.
Great. Thanks very much.
You got it. Barbara in North Carolina. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Sure.
Linda, I am in a rich area of UFO sightings. I have had many UFO sightings. One thing I wish to remind everyone about is the Chernobyl incident. If you remember, there during the second incident when Chernobyl was getting ready to explode again,
1986,
a huge UFO appeared all of a sudden and came down over it and prevented it. So let's all pray that this might happen for the
Fukushima.
Yeah, right. And
yeah, that is a very interesting point that you're making, because I remember even hearing that there was some kind of a craft, and it was supposed to be round in shape, did appear over Chernobyl at its big crisis point.
I heard that too.
Yeah, and that this would be an example of help. And I think all of us today, in the end of, well, March 2011, now April 1st, that if there has ever been a time on the planet where the number of crises, environmentally and others, seem to keep accelerating, and that we need help from advanced intelligence. So many people say, why don't the ETs just come down and help us clean up all of these messes? Well, the abduction syndrome, there are many people who say, no, the whole point is that we're being monitored, we're being watched, because we were set in motion genetically by one or more of the intelligences that interact with this planet. And that to interact with what has been set in motion in Homo sapien would destroy their experiment. There are an awful lot of ways to look at this phenomena And that's one of them, and it would also explain why there is not direct interaction.
Good point. Afreda, Washington, it's Terry's turn. Hey, Terry, go ahead. We'll get you in here.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call, Linda.
Sure. Yes.
My question is, first, I have a couple. It's about the UFO that I saw in Edmonds, Washington. I actually contacted Peter Davenport.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, we talked about what I saw and everything. And, of course, I was trying to get my video camera ready, and you guys were talking earlier about how things can be, you know, altered. My battery was dead.
Right.
I grabbed my other battery. I was able to charge it. And by the time I was able to actually get footage of this, just to explain what I saw, it was probably about a football field away. I would say probably 100 feet in the air. I just got home. I looked out the window. It was kind of hot. It was July. And, you know, I looked out there, and I thought I saw something, you know, but it was translucent. It almost looked like it was spinning so fast that I couldn't make out what it was. But I knew that, you know, to me, in my mind, I said, this is, and it made no noise at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really clear. If I didn't have a witness to see it with me, I would have thought that I was crazy, of course. And we stared at it for probably about 5 minutes, and just as I was able to get the camera working, just to where I could start taking a picture of it, it started to move left behind the apartment buildings across 99 on Aurora there. And, you know, to make a long story short, I contacted Peter after that, and I did take a shot of it afterwards. It was dusk. It was just starting to get light out. Anyway, I did finally find this footage, and you know, to let you know what it looked like when it was dark, it seemed to, every time I was trying to take a picture, it seemed to move in a different direction as I was trying to get a shot of it.
Right.
And then it, when I finally was able to focus it in on the camera, it again was making no noise, and there was lights flashing on it that were red and white that seemed to it's so hard to explain. You'd have to see it.
Okay, I've only got about 20 seconds left here.
I'll just say something really fast. That Travis Walton and a lot of other abductees are convinced that we are dealing with drone technology that might as well be a sensitive, intelligent, organic being, but it is somebody else's android that has the ability to consciously react, communicate, and retreat from.
Very good. Thanks, Linda. Thanks for being a good sport on April 1st. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.